Good morning, everyone. I'm Stacy Rasgon. I cover the U.S. semiconductor sector here at Bernstein, and it's my great honor today to introduce our guest, the Chief Financial Officer of Analog Devices, Mr. David Zinsner. Of all the companies I cover, ADI is typically thought of as one of the most respected, with an extremely high-quality franchise in the analog space, particularly as it relates to signal conversion and processing. Over the last 10 years or so, the company's embarked on a rationalization program of both their product portfolio as well as their manufacturing footprint. They were one of the few entities that were smart enough to exit the baseband business early enough to actually get paid to do it. And they've increasingly focused their product offerings on high-value applications, whatever the end market, as well as greatly increasing their presence in new markets, automotive, healthcare, even consumer recently. They took early steps before many of their peers also to shutter unnecessary capacity. I think this has borne fruit. The company's now operating in the ballpark of a long-term model that has trough margins that are considerably higher than their peak margins used to be, with a very solid level of cash return. And so given that, many of my conversations with investors on the company now focus on growth. Can ADI achieve a higher level of organic growth than they've shown in the past? Are new consumer and wireless wins good or bad, both for the business and for the stock, which are not always the same thing? Should the company be playing bigger on the M&A front? And what areas of innovation are now coming into focus in order for the company to drive that top line? So to answer these and other questions, it's my great pleasure to introduce the CFO of Analog Devices, Mr. David Zinsner. Dave, thank you so much for being with us here today.
Thank you, Stacy.
Three chairs here.
Yeah, exactly.
Not sure where to sit. So sit here. So I do want to, I guess, start with a broader strategy question. What do you think the biggest strategic imperative for Analog Devices is from where we're sitting here today going forward?
Well, I think, obviously what ADI does well is we focus on the intersection of the physical world with the digital world, mm-hmm. and where performance in some way matters, either it needs to be high speed, it needs to have unbelievable precision, it needs to operate under extreme conditions, areas where the problem is tough to solve and that mm-hmm. that alignment between the physical and the digital, that's really where we want to focus. And mm-hmm. so, I think even today, it's still the same thing. We want to just maintain the level of investment and develop the right technologies, to be able to address, mm-hmm. whatever the market needs in that space.
I guess what I'm asking more specifically, you've given a long-term EPS target.
Yeah.
Actually, on the last earnings call, the target used to be $4 to $5. Vince, on the last earnings call, said pretty clearly $5.
Yeah.
I mean, is that the end-all be-all of where you're trying to take the company? Like, how important is that EPS target in 2020 at this point? Is that the goal? Or
from a financial perspective, it's the goal. It's, I think the way I view it more than anything, and the reason we kind of put it out to Wall Street was kind of give ourselves this kind of beacon of where we mm-hmm. wanted to be from a financial perspective. And, obviously that was, was incumbent on driving the top line up, which last year we did $3.4 billion. I think back when we made that prediction, it was somewhere in the 2.5, 2.6 kind of range. Mm. So, we've made clear steps to get closer to the number that will give us that, $4 to $5 number. And it's about, just being very prudent in terms of how we manage the expenses and expanding the gross margins mm-hmm. to, kind of help out. So it's definitely part of the goal. I think our strategy is about developing technology and growing the business. Mm-hmm. I think the $4 to $5 and, as Vince said, pushing ourselves to the $5 side is really the outcome of the strategy more than mm-hmm. anything.
Got it. Do you think, though, that growth is probably the biggest lever that you have to get there? I mean, currently, I think there's some room on the model, but you're in the ballpark of the operating model as it stands today. So I guess could you give us a view, and you talked about how you have grown since you gave it. The growth mm-hmm. was primarily, though, from acquisitions and from consumer wins. Mm-hmm. The rest of the businesses, the core businesses I think about, has been a little more challenged.
Mm-hmm.
I guess could you give us a view on, and I think you've talked publicly about some of the headwinds that were driving that and how they may be, kind of troughing at
yeah.
this point. Maybe could you give us a point of view on some of the drivers? I guess two questions. The relative importance of the different drivers within the model in terms of growth versus margin expansion, and then some of the areas where you actually do believe that the company itself can actually return,
ideally the organic growth, or if not, whether M&A actually needs to be a bigger portion of the quiver right now.
Right. Well, clearly, I think, you know, of all the levers we have, and we have, you know, we can obviously, and we have been buying back stock and so forth. You know, we have a variety of levers that can kind of drive us to the high end of the $4 to $5 range, but the number one driver is definitely going to be revenue growth. Mm-hmm. And as you point out, you know, I think the growth really came more in the consumer space lately, not so much in the other markets, communication, industrial, and automotive. But, you know, there were various kind of idiosyncratic reasons why those things, for example, in the comm space, it was, you know, China had kind of slowed down their mm-hmm. capital spend. That's resumed. In the auto space, you know, we had kind of exited something that was a more commoditized part of the market. The growth is going to resume there. In fact, we'll have year-over-year growth next quarter. Mm-hmm. And even in the industrial space, you know, we were faced with a little bit of a macro headwind. That looks like it's troughed. We should have year-over-year growth in the industrial space. So I think we, you know, just without doing anything, I think it's kind of naturally moving towards, mm-hmm. you know, what we call the B2B space is moving towards a kind of a growth dynamic to it. And then on top of that, you know, there are very specific areas of that B2B space that I think have really good potential. In the industrial space, we're focused a lot on smart machine type markets. We have a great business in the military space, and that business has been growing well. We have a number of key wins in the healthcare space that will start generating revenue in the kind of 2017-18-19 kind of time frame, which should drive very good growth. The auto space, as I mentioned, you know, that's commoditized. There are a lot of good verticals in that space. In the infotainment area, we're seeing very good growth. Matter of fact, all the other markets outside of the area that commoditized, which was the passive safety market, have actually had double-digit growth. So mm-hmm. the passive safety is kind of, I think, leveled off at this point, and the other markets should carry the automotive business, I think, mm-hmm. you know, to grow very close to where it had historically grown before we had run into the headwind. And then the comm business, you know, it does have kind of ebbs and flows to it, but we have better market share in the comms business going forward. We'll be better positioned in 5G for sure than 4G. But even on the 4G side, as the technology integrates, we should be gaining share. Mm-hmm. On top of that, the small cell market in the comm space looks like a pretty good opportunity for us. I think we have a very strong position there. So I think there are a lot of, and you know, that's the beauty of the analog model. It's never one thing. Mm-hmm. And that's the benefit to us, but the challenge to communicate it is, wow. You know, it's like, you know, we make a lot of bets and it's a diversified model. And the idea is that we're not quite sure whether all of those bets will work out, but mm-hmm. enough of them should work out to give us a pretty decent growth rate, I think.
Got it. Now, again, when I think we've had these arguments before, but when I sort of work back from your kind of EPS target, mm-hmm. I get a top-line growth number that's in the ballpark of 10%. That's mm-hmm. what would kind of be required, at least at the midpoint of the margin ranges, in order to get there. Mm-hmm. Is that the right way investors should be thinking about it? And if that's the case, can you do it organically, or does M&A need to be a factor?
That's a good question. I do think that we do have a path to getting to the higher end of the operating margin range. Mm-hmm. I think there are good opportunities on the gross margin side. Matter of fact, this quarter, we'll bring our utilization down just to get our inventory more in line, and we'll still keep gross margins flat because we took out a decent amount of expense on the manufacturing mm-hmm. side, and there are more opportunities to do things like that. So I'm pretty confident we can get to the high end of the gross margin model,
which is 69.
I think it's 68 actually.
68, okay.
Moving us up.
Okay. All right.
And then on the operating margin side, you know, it's a lot to do with leverage, but mm-hmm. I think there are some efficiencies we can still get out of that model, or that part of the model as well. So I feel pretty good that, you know, we can get to the kind of more to the mid to, you know, upper mid, call it, of the operating margin range, which would kind of put us in the 35, 36, mm-hmm. maybe even 37% range on the operating margin side. So that would be a component of it. So that kind of reduces, I guess, the stress on the top line side. But it's
still probably 8, 9.
But you're right. It's still probably in the 8%.
Yeah.
I think, you know, probably organically this business grows more like 6, mm-hmm. You know, on a 5-year basis. So, you know, to get to the higher end of the range probably does take a little M&A. Mm-hmm. I don't think we do M&A for the sake of trying to hit a model. But I think there are things that we do want to have in our portfolio that we don't have today that my guess will be accretive, mm-hmm. Both to the revenue side and to the earnings side. And, you know, we have, 4 or 5 more years to go. So I would be surprised if we didn't find a couple of those things that would augment it. You know, Hittite actually, you know, of course there aren't a lot of these kind of high performance analog companies out there, but you know, Hittite did wonders for us. It added, you know, $300 million plus to the top line side, and it was probably accretive to, in the kind of mid-teens, maybe even upper teens at this point.
Got it. You think there's enough opportunities out there, even if we're not like going big on M&A, but like small to mid-size, but with an appropriate margin structure as well to keep you within that model?
Yeah, I think we'll be okay. The I would say that when we look at the gross margins and operating margins of businesses, we recognize sometimes when we acquire it, we're not necessarily going to get exactly what we want from a model standpoint. But you know, usually we have a, we can figure out a path to get get it up. And even in the case, you know, obviously Hittite had higher gross margins than we did, but we actually moved those gross margins up because we were able to take out costs both on the front end and on the back end side. So their gross margins now are probably in the mid to upper 70s at this point. So that. You know, that's kind of the model for us. So even if we got something in the kind of mid-50s, I think, you know, we would find something as long as it had the same characteristics of high performance, you know, that there was a cultural alignment with what we did or what we do. I think we, you know, we should be able to move gross margins on these companies that are smaller than us.
Got it. And I guess in that sort of operating model, how should investors be thinking about how the cash return strategy might stay the same or might change over the next
year? Our goal is to give 80% of our free cash flow to investors. And the way we break that down is, I'd say about half of that comes in the form of the dividend, so that's a more kind of guaranteed amount. And then the other half is buyback, and we kind of, you know, ebb and flow based on the dynamics of what the stock is doing. Last quarter, we bought a couple hundred million back. I think the quarter before, we might have bought $100 million back or something like that. So so it kind of ebbs and flows, but over, you know, when you look at it over a four-quarter or eight-quarter kind of horizon, it should kind of match up with that 80%. And then the other 20% plus the cash on hand is, you know, I think kind of the use for acquisitions.
Got it. I have to ask you, with the Hittite acquisition, you managed to use offshore cash. Is that something you think you could do again if you needed
to? Yeah, I mean, I think, well, what we did actually was we... Where the borrowing occurred was actually offshore, and then we paid the borrowing down with offshore cash, since both things were offshore. And that vehicle or that approach is based on our structure and the kind of presence we have in Ireland. It allows for that. So you know, it's deal specific, and you know, all the ducks have to line up, but it can be done. Yeah, on a relatively frequent basis.
I wanted to switch a little bit and talk about some of the end markets.
Okay.
First is just something you actually just mentioned. You said you had a number of healthcare wins that would be ramping in the 2018-2019 timeframe. Can you give us at least a general view of the types of end markets within healthcare that those might be going into and sort of relative size? Like how you don't split healthcare out yet. It's still part of the industrial, but so was auto once upon a time. It got big enough. Like, does healthcare get big enough in that time frame to split it out?
It could be, yeah. So it's, I think when automotive was... part of the industrial business. We actually captured it in the industrial business. I think it was kind of mid-single digits as a percent of revenue for the company. But we kind of, you know, as we looked at the opportunity pipeline, how it was lining up for the next 5 years, and that's the beauty of automotive is you get pretty good visibility, and the same is actually true for healthcare. We could kind of tell where it was going, and we thought, you know, we might want to break this out and give investors a better sense of, you know, how this business is behaving. The healthcare business is right around the same level at this point now. It's in the mid-single digits as a percent of revenue. But the way it's lining up in terms of design wins and opportunities, I think you could pretty soon you could start to set an expectation that maybe it should be broken out. And I think we probably will look at that. It's it largely when we focused in healthcare in the past, it had been in what we call big iron, which were big kind of imaging systems like CAT scans and ultrasounds and those kind of things. It's evolved to be more kind of portable vital signs monitoring type products because the precision requirements are increasing significantly in that space. You know, and other things that where performance matters like battery usage and so forth or power usage is important. So when it's got hard connectivity problems, hard measurement problems, has to be done in, you know, very low power environments. That's usually lines up for something that'll be fairly proprietary and what's what gets developed, and those are the things that we tend to focus on. So in this space, those are kind of the areas we're focused on. And the big healthcare companies, I think, are all pushing in that direction under the theme of IoT, I guess, in their definition of it.
I'll ask you about IoT in a little bit. But do you think, you know, people, like a lot of times in automotive and even now starting in industrial, they talk about like some level of content increase or multiplier. Do you think there's something similar that plays out in healthcare? Do you think that do you have any sort of idea what that multiplier might be?
Yeah, it's hard to tell because, I mean, for some of these, there was no content and now there'll be content, you know, so it's so significant. It's the change. But I would tell you that the peak revenue levels for these wins are measured in the tens of millions per year. So it's, and you stack up enough of those things, it's actually pretty meaningful.
Got it. So within automotive, you talked a little bit about like the passive safety, the MEMS business that's kind of rolled off. I guess two questions. Was there a change in the economics of that in that business over time that sort of, because it used to be a reasonably sizable player there.
Mm-hmm.
When did you see that change? And then I guess going forward, can you talk about the areas where you're investing in and playing in automotive today and what you think actually can drive the most growth? Like, people talk a lot about ADAS, for example, and everything else. Where are you actually playing in the car that you actually think can drive growth and return it to the trajectory that it was on?
Right. Yeah, so just to add a little color to what we did that is commoditized is we operated in the passive safety area. We provided MEMS, basically accelerometers. Those accelerometers, you know, kind of recognize the, you know, the stoppage of a car, and then based on that, fire an airbag, basically. And the level of performance was, you know, continually increasing. And in any market, when the performance levels constantly improve, those are generally good markets for us. Mm-hmm. Sometimes that just continues or it stabilizes. Sometimes they just kind of, they go with good enough and they use, you know, kind of other systems and software to overlay that on top of that to make it a more cost-effective solution. And that's really kind of what happened in that environment or that particular part of the market. And so it really never was huge in terms of its ROI, but it really started to get tough.
How big was it at its peak for you?
It was, probably like $170 million or something like that. So it was pretty big. Yeah. So anyway, there are certain parts of it that still do have performance, and we're actually winning new customers in certain areas that really want the performance. But there's a handful of customers that just don't really value it. And at some point, when we see that happening, our model is, you know, if that's going to happen, we just walk away from it. We'd rather focus on the areas where performance does matter. So that's what kind of happened in that part of the market. And then where we shifted a lot of the R&D was into three main parts of the automotive space. The first, which you mentioned, and it's the other side of the safety market, is the active safety market, you know, ADAS. And in that environment, that performance does really matter. And the beauty of the acquisition of Hittite is we get a whole lot of microwave technology, which is really where we play in the ADAS space with 24 gigahertz microwave. It's going to move to millimeter wave, 77 gigahertz. And as it moves to that, I think we even have a better position to gain share. So I think we'll have a great position now, but I think the opportunity to even be in a better position in the 77 gigahertz, which probably won't happen until 18, 19, probably two, looks very strong. And then on top of that, just, you know, the ADAS itself is proliferating. And as it proliferates, you know, that's where, you know, into, you know, more and more cars, that's where we also get a lift. The other two markets we focus on are infotainment. We do a lot of audio products in infotainment. We just announced in the first quarter a partnership with Ford on what's called A2B, which is a way of distributing audio through the car and really take out a lot of the cabling and stuff, lower the weight of the car, and actually just, you know, make it easier to network that whole, all the audio stuff together. It's gotten great traction. I'd say almost every automaker, every OEM is interested in discussing it with us. So I think we'll have really good share in that market with this new technology. And then on the powertrain side, we have, you know, kind of a host of just what you'd call traditional kind of powertrain stuff. But more and more of that's more and more of the things that were being done mechanically are going to shift over to being done with semiconductors, like magnetic resistance right now is a mechanical thing for the most part, but it's shifting over to what's called AMR, which is solved in silicon. There is battery sensing for electric vehicles and so forth. That all has to be done now in silicon. So, just increasingly as more cars get more sophisticated in terms of electronics and electrical and trying to take weight out of the car and get rid of all these mechanical devices, there's just a steady kind of stream of opportunities in that space.
Got it. For that A to B audio, can you give us a ballpark estimate of the kind of content we're talking about? And I think more broadly, can you give us an estimate of what you think your content overall in an average
car.
Automobile is?
See, it's so hard to say because it's all based on configuration. And but, it ranges anywhere from, it ranges anywhere from a couple of bucks to well over $100 for a car. The A to B, depending on whether they add, like a DSP capability and all that stuff, it could be up there in the higher end of the range, actually, with DSPs.
In terms of that's
dollar content.
That solution could be $100?
The solution with DSPs and all that, could be.
Okay. Well,
I want to ask about IoT. It's been coming up a lot in a number of these sessions. I'm going to start with, how do you define IoT? What is ADI's definition? How do you actually think about
define it? Stacey, that's actually a really good question because, I don't know, in some ways, internally, we don't have a business called IoT. we don't run a P&L called IoT. I would say that our customers do want to marry the data that they can collect out of the physical world and to get it to the cloud and then provide analysis. That their value in this is providing information back to their customer. What I think we do particularly well, and which really is an evolutionary thing that's been going on for probably since our existence, but even in the more sophisticated way over at least the last 10 years, is we provide that ability to collect the physical information, convert it, and connect it. And that's what we do. That's all we do. And so that, I guess that's how I would define how we think about IoT, but it is basically how we define our company. That's exactly what we do. We're not interested in providing devices that people wear around their wrist and all that stuff, or even at the even in the industrial side, we're not interested in providing a complete networked system to cloud thing that, because that's what our customers do. But where they have performance challenges, where they want to get this information in really harsh environments and, get it up to the cloud and in some ways do some control at the edge, that's where we provide the capability to do that.
But it sounds like you don't really view yourselves as having a need in helping customers develop, say, use cases, business models, analytics, the applications that are sort of running. Do you actually see the value within the semiconductors itself?
Yeah.
Is it okay?
No, I think there's probably, clearly there's a part of the market that where all of that stuff is easy to do, and I think it's, a lot of these kind of more consumer-oriented things, but there's a whole other side of this market where collecting that data from the physical world and, doing some sort of control and connectivity is actually pretty hard to do, and that's where we add value, and that's where we focus.
Do you have all of the connectivity that you actually need?
One way or another. We have obviously we have a lot of connectivity because we have, on a B2B basis, we have probably one of the richest portfolios of connectivity in RF and microwave in the industry. There are these kind of more standardized type connectivities like Zigbee and industrial Bluetooth and so forth. But those are, licensable, so and that's how we address that.
Got it. If I could shift gears to the industrial market. So it sounds like many companies are seeing, we want to hope it's some sort of nascent recovery. We're not quite sure. Most of what we heard is kind of things are not great. They're kind of weak. They're not really getting better, but they're not necessarily getting worse either. So they're, you know, we've been kind of bobbling along here on this low level, kind of macro driven for a while.
Right.
Is that still what you're saying? It kind of more sounded like maybe you were starting to see at least some.
Yeah, maybe I'm a little bit more optimistic than that. Or, but you know, the thing about industrials, it's measured in, you know, 10 basis point increments in terms of how different it could be. But you know, I think year over year we should have growth in the industrial business. In the third quarter, that's, you know, I think you can take some positive out of that.
Mm-hmm.
We had good sequential growth in the second quarter; it was up 11% from the first quarter. So, I do feel like it had bottomed and it's on a kind of maybe a very slight, you know, kind of recovery at this point. But it's by no means at this point robust. Yeah.
You're still running well below the kind of peak levels in industrial, which I think were driven. I can't remember which natural disaster drove it, but it was there was a pull forward.
It was the earthquake.
It was the earthquake.
Tsunami,
okay.
Yeah.
It just seems like a lot. I don't know if something happened, if that was all just inventory work done, because it seems like a lot, or if there's something else that happened under the covers, maybe something similar to what we saw in automotive that took some of that volume away. Did we see anything like that, or was this?
Yeah,
just
nothing
a
like a share thing, but it was definitely there was. To us, at least, I mean, we do have a pretty heavy exposure to companies who ultimately sell into the oil and gas space.
Mm-hmm.
So that, I think that did affect us a bit.
Mm-hmm.
And so that probably had some effect on us. And then, you know, depending on your measurement period, we also have a decent exposure into ATE. And,
automated test equipment.
Yeah.
Okay.
And beyond just semiconductors into, you know, it's pretty pervasive. And so, you know, that market has good quarters and bad quarters all the time, and so that actually has an effect as well. But I'd say generally it was, you know, it's a very, very broad, it must be 80,000 customers in that space.
The oil and gas statement and energy statement is interesting. I never really, and I don't think most investors think about ADI as a company that has a lot of exposure in that space. What, can you give us a ballpark,
so
where your exposure is?
I can't, because it's just a guess, but I mean, we sell into Honeywell and those kind of guys. It's those guys who then, like, for example, we sell a lot into safety products into a lot of these customers.
Mm-hmm.
A lot of that safety stuff ends up getting purchased by the natural resource companies, and so when they aren't expanding or, you know, they're kind of shutting things off, they stop buying any of that stuff that replaces their old things, and it was more that effect than anything.
Okay, but you don't have, you're too far back in the chain to have
really
too
far back in the chain.
Got it. What are you seeing in China now? Because that, again, has been one driver of, you know, some of the softness that we've seen. And, again, there's some hope that maybe we're seeing some recovery. What are you seeing?
We had a good quarter. We had a great quarter in the first quarter for China. It was up a bit again in the second quarter. I was actually, funny, I was just on the phone with the guy that runs China for us last night. And he said things are plugging along. You know, it's you know, our China business is really two markets for the most part. It's industrial and it's comms.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, comms was suffering a bit last year because of this, you know, whatever it was, you know, stoppage of capital spend for a while. That has recovered. You know, we're back on recovery. And they're also starting to deploy small cell technology, which is kind of fantastic for us. So that looked positive. But he also said the industrial business is, you know, kind of plugging along.
Mm-hmm.
So we've seen really no weakness at this point.
Mm-hmm. Got it. And I guess on the comm front, this is the second or third time you've mentioned small cells. Obviously, the content in the small cell is going to be worse than the base station, but there'll be a lot more of them, presumably.
Yeah.
Can you give us a view, how much of the comm business today is small cell versus macro, and like how do you see that mix trending?
It's a nit right now. I mean, it's really small.
Uh-huh.
You know, there are a couple of carriers that really see small cell as their way of densification.
Mm-hmm.
There are other carriers that don't see small cell as a meaningful part of their
mm-hmm.
densification strategy. You know, China, I think it's China Mobile, right, Ali? In China, I think Verizon here, they actually have some interest in really helping out their network, offloads a lot of their data to these small cells. So there'll be big players in it, but others won't. So, you know, my guess is, even if you look out to 2020, it's still not going to be more than 15%, 20% of our wireless exposure.
Got it. So lots of growth, but off of a
small base.
Okay.
I mean, I just look at it more like a lot of this stuff is, in the small cell side, is done with an integrated transceiver. So it integrates everything onto a single IC. And that technology is actually finding its way back into the macro side. That's how radios are getting, you know, that the requirements around radio technology are getting solved through integrated transceivers at this point on the macro side because of how the small cell kind of developed. So it's more of a catalyst for, I think, a position for ADI for the entire network more than anything.
Okay. I want to switch to the consumer side now because that's been sort of one of the bigger revenue ramps and also one of the bigger controversies of the last year or so. I was wondering if you could comment a little bit on your rationale for getting into the business, because there seems to be a bit of a disconnect between what may be good for your business and, at least in the near term, what has been good for the stock.
Yeah, I would say that, I mean, at the end of the day, we're trying to generate as much cash flow as possible.
Yeah.
I mean, you know, we have various constituents to concern ourselves with, but as it relates to shareholders, we're worried about generating cash flow. And as long as something checks the box on, you know, is it high performance? Is it, you know, proprietary? Does it have some legs to it? Will we get a good ROI? Will it generate good cash flow? As long as it does that, I have to say, we're probably agnostic to the market for the most part. And obviously, when it's in the consumer space, it gets a higher degree of scrutiny because, you know, a lot of times you think you're getting those boxes checked when you're not getting those boxes checked. But I think in this case, we felt pretty confident we were. So, I recognize that it has perhaps more volatility than some of the rest of the businesses. But, you know, in times when the other businesses weren't that, you know, were less robust, shall we say, that one is the one that, you know, carried the reins for us. So I think it actually worked in the sense that it was part of the diversification of the model, and it drove growth when the others didn't. So, you know, that's basically our strategy, and we're going to kind of stick to it. I would tell you that we didn't spend that money. You know, we all the operating cash flow from that business really fell to the bottom line. It was a very minimal R&D investment.
Well, that was my next question.
Yeah.
This was a product that most of the investment was done for other things, and it was repurposed.
That's right.
So the ROI should have been incredibly high.
It was huge. And, you know, it was part of the big chunk of the $1 billion we returned over the last four quarters. So I think it worked for everybody, quite honestly.
Do you think this is, a space that you would seek to expand with other customers, or was this designed for the single customer at this point?
Well, this one was designed really with the single customer in mind, and there's a there's kind of an alignment with what the customers, you know, the customer had to put a lot of wrapper around this technology in order to make it work in their environment, and in order to provide it to other customers, for one, we'd probably have to do all that other stuff, which that would be a different level of investment, and we're not interested in doing that. I do think, you know, there are pockets of consumer that still do check the box on all these things around proprietary and performance, and we will, you know, kind of selectively find the ones that we think have the highest probability of success. And, you know, I don't know what that means for a consumer, whether it's, you know, it probably isn't to the percentage of revenue that it was last year. But, you know, can it be more than 10%? It's probably somewhere in between, you know, where it ultimately kind of levels off at.
And I guess tactically with this customer that you had talked about, I think you talked about content increase. Was this related to the current product, which is the Force Touch, or is it related to something else?
There were different things. We, pretty good performance on our part in terms of getting the technology out and ramping it, they did open up a bunch of other things to us that they thought were tough problems they wanted to see if we could solve. We didn't pick all of them. We've just picked a few of them and said, okay, these ones we think have the best opportunity for a return for us and probably align better with our capabilities. And so those are the ones we chose. And as it turns out, those all ended up in the next generation of the product. So it actually worked out. So, you know, in the consumer space, there's analog in general, the ASPs are erosion is actually not that high. But in this one, you know, it's a little bit more than probably the average. But the great thing was we got a bunch of additional opportunities in things that are still I guess, human interface related, but different in terms of their functionality and what they do. And that allowed us to get an ASP that, you know, actually increases mm-hmm. from where we were, or at least BOM increases from where we were before.
Got
with
it.
That customer.
Maybe one more question on this. Any lessons learned in terms of managing this channel?
Well, I would say, you know, like I said, the revenue thing, I would say, wasn't that much of an issue. Even in the first quarter when it fell off like it did, our operating margins, I think, were 28%
yeah.
that quarter. So, you know, I think when I got here, our peak operating margins, as you mentioned, were 24. So it seemed like a pretty good outcome. The thing that I felt was a little disappointing was that we had to write down some of the inventory. Like, we built too much inventory. And it was actually a pretty meaningful amount of inventory that we had overbuilt. And I think the lesson that we came away with was that, you know, everywhere along the supply chain, from the first person at ADI that starts wafers all the way through our process, all the way through their processes, to the ultimate customer, there's buffer built in. And so you don't need to build a whole lot of your own buffer, you know, to compensate for that. So we have definitely kind of, you know, wrung it out a
okay.
bit in terms of how we build on a go-forward basis. I think ultimately those wafers are going to, the ones that we built, we're all ultimately going to find a home for anyway.
They're still usable.
Yeah. So we'll see how that goes. And certainly if we end up selling a product out at 100% gross margin, we'll isolate that and let the investors really understand that. But I think even if we do find out, it still wasn't great that we built inventory, you know, quarters before we really needed it, as it turns out. So that was the biggest lesson.
Got it. Okay. I think more generally, you guys have talked a little bit in the past about the increasing importance of doing integrated products.
Mm-hmm.
Can you talk a little bit about how, I guess, define that and view that, and how would you characterize ADI's ability to develop those products, and importantly, to actually get customers to pay you that additional value to do that development?
Right. So it's, I think really it starts with, you know, why is that actually happening? So the main thing that drives this is customers themselves are hollowing out their engineering resources on the hardware side
mm-hmm.
to focus on the software side. And as a result, they can't spend a lot of time trying to figure out all these components and how they need
mm-hmm.
to get fit on a board and then, you know, some of the algorithms that have to be layered on top of that, and they would normally have to write those algorithms. So what they're doing is they're pushing us to do more of that. The challenge is not to get kind of pulled into an ASIC model where you're doing these one-off things for one customer that you can't leverage to the rest of the market, because if you do that, it's hard to make money doing that,
mm.
as a lot of companies have found out that have focused
yeah.
on ASIC. So what we do is we try to create a platform out of anything that we're doing so that it has broad applicability.
Mm-hmm.
We try to layer on an ability to do kind of software, kind of make them software defined in a way that
mm-hmm.
so the customers can kind of, you know, tweak the parameters themselves to optimize the system for themselves. But that can all be done in software as opposed to hardware.
Mm-hmm.
So, you know, it's not like we have to spin different parts for different customers
okay.
that have unique characteristics. And I think when you do that, you can get really good return on it. And then ultimately, obviously, you got to get them to pay for the additional amount. But I think, you know, that is where ADI is actually very good at
mm-hmm.
that. I mean, we developed this algorithm that basically does the digital predistortion in comms. And if they take the algorithm, they actually pay, I think it's almost twice as much as they would pay for the hardware, because it takes out so much hardware for them. I mean, they obviously see the value in it. But, you know, ADI does a good, you know, the market guys do a very good job of recognizing the value of the product they're providing
mm-hmm.
and, you know, making sure we get a fair return for that.
Have you been doing more of that? I know when Jerry was there, he talked a lot about increasing efforts to do value pricing, for example.
Mm-hmm.
This was something that maybe had not been pushed as much as it could have been in the
mm-hmm.
past, and that was definitely, is this something you've continued to increase focus on?
Yeah, that's it's a big component. Actually, there's a whole initiative, partly that actually I manage, around pricing and how to drive
mm-hmm.
more just to pay for the value of the things we provide. Like one of the hidden ones that I remember Jerry saying this, like he went to a customer and the customer said, you know, we're still buying a part for you from 1970. I can't remember the exact year. I think it was 1978. And Jerry went, oh, really? He goes, yeah, we would hate it if you ever end up like that part. And Jerry walked out and said, boy, we can get paid for that. And so it's, you know, we're finding the things that really drive our value and trying to extract as much return for that mm-hmm. value as possible. And that's one of them is that we don't end up like parts generally. And so people really like the fact that they can buy a part from 1978.
Yeah, I think they showed my chart recently. But
I think we still have it in the investor.
What is it, 5% or so of the products are 20 years or old?
Yeah.
Or like
so. I think the very first temperature sensor we ever developed, we're still selling. I think it makes $15 million a year in revenue or something like that.
That's great. What are you doing on the DSP front these days? I know that used to be a bigger business. It's, you know, it's not visible anymore in the, you don't break it out anymore.
Yeah, it's, I mean, the problem is that a lot of this stuff is so integrated, it's hard to even know what it should be called. Like a lot of stuff, I think, gets lumped, you know, at least from a market research perspective, gets lumped into data converters, but it does all kinds of functionality. The DSP space, what we try to do, we have a couple of cores, I guess you'd call them, you know, what we call Blackfin and
Shark.
And Tiger Shark, I think it was. And and we just mainly leverage those cores and, you know, basically done derivatives off of it.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, it's a decent business. It's been around probably the same as when we last reported it was a few years ago.
Mm-hmm.
A lot of the stuff gets sold into the automotive space for audio solutions. So we've definitely focused in the auto mm-hmm. space. And then, you know, various parts of the industrial space where they need, where we actually have, if we're going to build a solution, you know, some of the control and processing needs to be done by us, you know, we'll leverage that technology to do that.
Got it. We've got about 8 minutes left. I wanted to give you a reminder, if you have questions, now would be the time to send them up, and we'll make sure to leave room for that. I want to switch a little bit to, no, they're going to.
Oh, I was just pointing because she was looking.
Okay. I guess while we're waiting, if we kind of talk a little bit more on the operational side now, and you talked a little bit about your free cash flow return targets and everything else, but I guess in terms of the balance sheet itself, do your, I guess, current levels of onshore cash, both location and generation rates, does that support the free cash flow targets that you're looking for? Do you think you need to, you've been taking on debt a little bit at a time over the years to kind of offset that balance, but where do you think
it's goes? What we generally do is we pay, what we get in U.S. cash flow, we pay in the form of the dividend.
Mm-hmm.
And so when we do buybacks, we actually are using cash that's offshore.
Okay.
Obviously, we can't physically do that because we would incur a cost to do that. So we generally use leverage on our U.S. balance sheet to fund that. And that's why we do have debt on our balance sheet.
Got it. So you think that will continue, though?
Yeah.
Absent.
And it's not a huge amount, you know, any 1 year. In fact, Ali's team actually did it. What we did last December was we put a whole bunch of cash on there, just so we had a whole bunch of cash. I think we have $1 billion in just the cash that we can then use to, you know, fund the buyback.
Mm-hmm. Got it. I guess as the mix of the business has changed, like how should investors be thinking about incremental, I mean, investors often think about incremental gross margins when they model.
Mm-hmm.
How should people thinking about how, I guess, incremental gross margins over the next 5 years might compare with where they were over the last 5 years?
Like the fall through, basically.
The fall through, because it seems like your margins have gone up over the last few years, and it seems like you're still suggesting there can be a little more.
I think generally the rule of thumb has been it's been about 80% gross margins on the fall through, and I think that's a pretty good rule of thumb.
Got it.
And hopefully we can press it a little harder with some of the cost initiatives we've gotten, but the general basic business.
And it didn't seem like the consumer business was hugely margin dilutive. Maybe like a tiny bit.
That's exactly what I would characterize it.
Got it. In general, how do you think about prioritizing your investments in products? So you talked about like in areas where, it's we're not getting paid anymore, we're pulling back. But in general, I guess, what are the factors that you use to determine whether a particular business or a product line is a good use of resources? Is it just around the capabilities you bring? Is it around the margin structure? Is it around what customers are asking for?
Yeah, I mean, I'd say broad, you know, we do a strategic analysis where we look broadly at which markets we think have good opportunities, which don't. At the more kind of granular level, what we generally do is we look at each business and say, you know, is it growing? If it's growing, then good, you know, mm-hmm. it's fine. If it's not growing, then we decide whether can it grow. If it can grow, then of course it probably gets funding too if it has mm-hmm. growth factors. And generally, I would say, you know, everybody starts with a, you know, is this proprietary? Is this mm-hmm. street? And if it's that, generally going to get. I think I lost my mic.
Well,
it's generally going to get, you know, good gross margins. And then if it's not growing, then, you know, a lot of those things end up being more kind of cash cow oriented type products. And, you know, we kind of rank order them, and, you know, there's always a demand that's higher than what we have to spend, and so we kind of lop off the ones we have the least amount of confidence in.
Mm-hmm. Got it. And overall, like, what's the overarching metrics that you manage things? So, like, you have a competitor who manages to free cash flow growth per share, and that's however they get that, that's all they care about. Is there something overarching that you're managing?
At a business unit level?
Just at a business unit and even at a corporate level.
Yeah, so we, I mean, you know, that from a financial metric perspective, we do look at the earnings level. Mm-hmm. And so, you know, at the top level, we look at this $4 to $5 and trying to push to the higher end of that range. And at the business unit level, we look at their operating profit, and they got to grow their operating profit. So they make the various trades off on growth and, you know, where that market sits in terms of gross margin and how much they need to invest in order to drive that growth, ultimately to try to drive their operating cash flow. And in general, that's actually a pretty good proxy for cash flow, actually, mm-hmm. which is why we do it, because CapEx and depreciation are kind of an offset.
I guess one of the other drivers of earnings has been taxes. Your tax rate is reasonably low.
Mm-hmm.
Is this structure, is this as a function of where you're? I know you guys, you do have very sizable offshore manufacturing and development,
right.
other things, but is this, how should investors be thinking about how that's going to trend? Because that's one of the, I guess, differences between you and some of your peers, is your tax rate has been structurally lower.
Right.
It seems like you manage that, the overall tax strategy seems to be managed fairly well.
Yeah, you know, ADI, long before I got there, developed a relationship with Ireland and put a factory in there. A fair amount of our R&D is done in Ireland. A lot of the management team is in Ireland. So we have a lot of presence there.
Mm-hmm.
That actually happens to be a country where the tax rate is, where they are actually more business friendly and kind of push the tax rate mm-hmm. in order to drive business there. And so most of our international activity gets done out of Ireland, and that's kind of, you know, for the most part, hasn't changed. I wouldn't imagine our tax rate changes much, quite honestly, mm-hmm. from where it is today.
Got it. Would you ever consider taking on larger amounts of leverage and doing more on the buyback front? Or is that still, are the buybacks still driven, I guess, like you said, by, I think you've said you have an algorithm, basically,
mm-hmm.
on the stock price, but why not do something bigger?
We could. I mean, mainly, and probably over time, we will have increasingly more leverage. I would say it's more of a, you know, the problem is, and this is like, you know, depends on how you manage your portfolio, but there's a benefit to kind of dollar cost averaging, because
uh-huh.
you never know when, you know, the market will be too high or too low, and you're not quite sure whether you bought into a high market or a low market. So what we try to do is, you know, kind of watch the movements on a quarter-to-quarter basis,
mm-hmm.
and it's, as you point out, it's more algorithmic. You know, it just mm-hmm. buys when, you know, it's, at least from a historical perspective, is on the low end,
mm-hmm.
and we recognize that, you know, every year we'll be buying stock back, and over time it will average out to be a very good price,
mm-hmm.
And that's been our approach. You know, as I point out, you know, we don't have, as this cash generates offshore, we actually have to take on more and more leverage to go do that.
Mm-hmm.
And so my guess is you'll see us have a higher leverage model over time. But at the end of the day, we kind of, you know, conservatively run mm-hmm. the balance sheet, partly because I think if we were going to do, if we did want to take on leverage in a more meaningful way, it probably would make sense to do that in the context of an M&A transaction as opposed to buyback.
Got it. So it doesn't appear that we have any questions. I don't know if that's good or bad, but I'll give you a soapbox. We've got a little bit of time left. Why should investors buy ADI stock?
Well, thanks.
Everything I said.
before. I'd just say that the beauty of ADI is it's a very diversified model, has very high moats around it. Most of our products are proprietary. We actually don't have a part-for-part competitive part out there, and it has very low capital intensity, and so it just generates lots of cash flow, and that cash flow is pretty well protected. I think even in 2009, when the downturn occurred, we generated over $400 million of free cash flow. That was our worst year. So this is a business that, as an investor, if you like a cash flow story, and a cash flow story that's consistent regardless of the economic cycles, ADI is the company to invest in.
Got it. We're out of time. Thank you so much.
Thank you, Stacey.